I'm a physicist, so this is going to be a physics tutorial. So I'm speaking 2 hours on two subjects that you've heard something about over the last few days, and maybe both you've heard something about, that are both important in cellular and molecular biology in some sense, physics issues. So the first hour today, I'm just going to talk about electrostatic effects. So electrostatics, as most of you know, is dominant in most biological processes. Then the second lecture, later in the afternoon, I'm just going to change things completely and just talk about membranes. You heard a lot out, but I'll talk about membranes from a slightly different pure physics point of view. So both of these lectures are not meant to do anything new. They're meant to be tutorials in that I'm going to tell you kind of what everybody who's working in these relevant subfields knows. Okay, so for those of you who are experts, and there are some here, Marcus is sitting here, who knows probably more about electrostatics than I do, but he doesn't have to listen. So Marcus, if I say something wrong, or if you want to put in 2 cents, just feel free to do it. Okay, so this is just meant to be tutorial. This is kind of textbook stuff, although maybe it's all hard to find in textbooks unless you look at the right place. Okay, so electrostatics. Why electrostatics? Basically, to a first approximation, all biological molecules, both proteins and nucleic acids, and most those are the biological polymers, but many of the biological lipids as well are charged. Okay, and we know that electrostatics plays a crucial role in a lot of structural things and maybe dynamical things, which is what we're learning about now. And I'll just give you a couple of examples just to motivate why one is interested in this. So everybody knows what DNA looks like. Remember, there's one base pair every 3.5 angstroms along the typical duplex DNA backbone. Every base pair has 2 phosphate groups on the backbone, which when water will ionize. So they have 1 negative charge in a fully ionized DNA, one charge roughly every 1.7 angstroms along the chain. Okay, so as far as charge polymer physics is concerned, polyelectrolyte physics, that's the most highly charged polymer that I know of. And it's probably as highly charged as you could ever get, because after all, an angstrom is the atomic size, the size of a hydrogen atom, and you can't get anything charges closer together than that. So that's about the limit of what's physically doable. In many cases, it's easier to think of DNA if you're very simplistic, you can think of it as a cylinder whose radius is about a nanometer. So if you, instead of treating it as a charged line, you could treat it as a charged cylinder, and for many purposes it's not bad. Then what's important is the charge per unit area of the cylinder. And that's roughly speaking, just using the numbers I gave you, about 1 charge per square nanometer. 1 charge per square nanometer is what I call a highly charged surface. We don't have surfaces in real life that have a higher charge density, significantly higher charge density of 1 charge per square nanometer. That's about it.
How does that compare to histamine, for example? I mean, to heparin.
I don't know that one.
Yeah, heparin is
don't know it.
Anticoagulant.
But many proteins have similar charge densities. I'll show you microtubules. have the same charge density. Intermediate filaments, similar. They're all similar.
It's because I heard that said about heparin, you know, one of the most highly charged.
Yeah, I don't know that.
Sugar polymer,
yeah. Don't know that one. But that's about. But just to remember that if you think of charged surfaces, one charge per square nanometer is it. You never get anything that's more highly charged than that, and you will see why. Okay. Yeah.
Well, so you're saying one base. I mean, for my research, I actually wanted to know like the actual size of one nucleotide. So you're saying it's a 3.5 by 3.5 by 3.5.
No, it's in the distance between base pairs is 3.5 angstroms.
Oh, I see.
In the standard B form DNA. I mean, it's slightly different in other forms. Okay.
Would you happen to know like the other dimensions? I mean, between base pairs, 3.5. But
yeah, and I'd say, and you think of it as a diameter of 2 nanometers.
Okay.
And then there's details on the pitch, whether you know there's two kinds of grooves. You don't see it so well here. There's a major groove and a minor groove, and those are details which are not going to be important for me. That's why I'm not talking about it. But continue to ask questions. So these things are highly charged. Remember, one charge per square nanometer. That's an important number. For many years, there was this problem of DNA condensation. How DNA, you know, DNA in animals could be meters long. I mean, it's this small cylinder, a nanometer radius cylinder that could be millimeters or meters long in animal cells. Or at least many microns long in bacteria, and yet they get these things have to get stuffed into, say, a viral capsid whose size is a micron. How does something so highly charged get scrunched up, into such a small thing? So that was a major problem. It's not a problem anymore, but that's clearly an electrostatics issue that you got to overcome. And what we know about this is that this is engendered, I'm not going to make a bit, by multivalent cations. Okay. In real life, everything is neutral. So even though the DNA is highly charged, there are neutralizing cations, maybe sodiums or something like that. But if you put in, let's say you take a DNA in vitro, just take a test tube with DNA, and you titrate in a little trivalent cations or tetravalent cations, you generate, quickly find that the DNA generates pictures like this. This is from a picture from Nick Hutt. I mean, there are many, many pictures like this. I just happen to have his around. And the DNA, you see, winds around, forms a torus, very tight. And this is not. And this is typical what happens. I mean, you have to take my word for it. This is a microscopy picture. This could be one out of a billion, but it's not. This is what you see most of the time in the presence of multivalent cations. What nature uses to stuff DNA into viral capsids are not lanthanum or aluminum ions, but uses small molecules that are either trivalent or tetravalent called spermidine or spermine, and I won't draw them on. They're just small little molecules. In animal cells, it uses multivalent cations that are a little bit more complicated, called histones, which are themselves proteins. But I don't want to give a talk about chromatin. But all I wanted to tell you is that these kinds of structures, these toroidal structures, are engendered by multivalent cations. Okay, a typical picture. The fact that they form a torus is not a big deal. It's because I didn't tell you DNA is relatively stiff, the duplex DNA. It has what's called a persistence length of about 50 nanometers. That is, if you want to bend DNA, it's hard to bend it on a radius of curvature smaller than about 50 nanometers. And that's what the length scale is here. Okay, so that's why they form donuts. All this is telling you is that the DNA wants to stick to itself. So even though it's highly charged, the presence of multivalent cations give rise to attractive forces. Okay. This is a microtubule. Nothing to show you here. Microtubules are proteins. it's a hierarchical assembly of proteins called alpha and beta tubulin. It makes no difference. The only thing is these also form long cylinders. They can be many, many, many meters long. It's much stiffer because they're much stiffer than DNA because they're much fatter. They're 10 times the diameter of DNA. And so these things could be many, many, many meters long, very rigid. They don't bend very easily. And they also have a charge density, that's my cell phone, similar to similar to DNA. Just ignore it. Now, in the presence of multivalent cations, again, these things also stick together. And this is obviously a cartoon. I'll show you some electron micrographs. They form dense clusters like this in the presence of, these are the valences of tetravalent or pentavalent cations. And divalent cations, they still stick together and form looser clusters. Okay, so again, this is a case not of nucleic acids, nothing special about that one is a nucleic acid and the other is a polypeptide. They do same things. Multivalent cations engender attractive forces. So this is a cartoon. These are the microscopy pictures from, this is stuff that I just happen to have. This is all from Santa Barbara, from Safini's group in Santa Barbara. This is the pictures from Dan Needleman, who's now at Harvard. His thesis, and these are just the TEM pictures associated with the cartoons that I showed you on the last picture, on the last view graph. It's easier to see what's going on here. So this is just to convince you that there are strong electrostatic effects. Okay. So what I want to do is say a little bit today how people think about electrostatics in this context. And I'm not going to talk very much about these attractive forces. The attractive forces are well understood. Several of the people in here, Roland and Marcus, have been involved in various things with that. But I want to give you the standard view that people have of how to deal with electrostatic problems of charged surfaces. Just so when later on in this workshop, when people start talking about this stuff, you know what they're talking about. Okay. So that's kind of what I want to do. And what I'm going to do is do most of it on the blackboard, because I think it's always better for pedagogically speaking, you can do things on the blackboard. Okay, so in fact, maybe I'll just turn this off. If I could figure out how to.
Do you want me to turn off the projector?
I could that'd probably be better.
Just put something in front of it so you don't.
Yeah.
So the most important thing one has to understand, in my view, about electrostatics of any of these kinds of systems is the standard old-fashioned mean field picture. So what I'm going to tell you all about today is something like 17th century physics. This is stuff that was all known a long time ago, but I want to make sure that everybody knows it. So a lot of this stuff is stuff we teach in undergraduate physics courses. So what I want to do is say a little, remind you, I think you all know this, about charged surfaces. And then I'll talk about the mean field theory, which is called Poisson, Boltzmann, or vice versa. And all of the important physics is associated with this, or most of it you can see in an approximation, which is called the Debye-Hückel. And that has most of the important physics that's associated with everything that we want to talk about. Okay, so I'm gonna be, so to begin with, I'm gonna assume that you've all had some kind of electrostatics course. And I'll just remind you about a few of the things that you may have forgotten, but just ask questions. So I'm old, and since I'm old, I'm allowed to use the wrong units. I can use CGS units. I hate MKS units for electrostatics. So if those of you who have to put in 4 pi over epsilon zeros or 4 pi epsilon zeros to get the right units. So the important thing, so let me first talk about charged surfaces, because we saw that DNA is something like a charged cylinder, microtubules, intermediate filaments, actin, they're all like charged cylinders. Some of the times we're talking about histones, they're sort of like, almost like charged spheres. So we want to look at charged objects. And so I have to just make sure that we're all on the same wavelength. And just to remind you of some things. So the first thing, let's talk about a sphere. So let's talk about, assume we have a uniformly charged sphere of some radius, and we call it capital R, and that has a charge on it. Uniformly distributed, you can think of it all on the surface, or uniformly distributed on the surface, a certain charge, which I'll call Q, and sitting in some medium with a dielectric constant, I'll call epsilon. And then you ask, what's the electric field from that sphere? And I'll use Gauss's law, if you remember Gauss's law. That the integral around any closed surface is equal to 4 pi in my units times the charge. And if you're using some other units, then this 4 pi is different. Okay. By spherical symmetry, you just, of course, D is epsilon. Tensors here, so immediately this says that the electric field is just something like Q over epsilon R squared. Just using my numbers, where R is the distance to where you are, and I'm only interested in distances outside. And since the electric field, and of course it's radial, you know, it's pointed away or taught it depending on the sign, and of course I can write this as the derivative of the negative derivative of the potential with respect to R. It's a definition of the potential, and therefore the potential is Q over epsilon R plus or minus depending on the sign of the charge. Okay, the important thing, everybody knows, I'm saying this fast because I'm assuming this is second nature to everyone. Is this a problem? Okay, so the important thing to notice here, I could take the potential has an arbitrary constant because it's only the gradient that's defined, and I've taken it so that the potential is zero at infinity. No problem to do that. Okay, R was infinity was zero. No problem. Let me contrast that. I do the same thing with the cylinder. Cylinder of some radius. I use the same Gauss's law, and now I'm thinking of this as an infinite cylinder, so I'll call lambda as a charge per unit length. I'll just use a continuum picture for the moment. it's infinite. And if you just do the same thing, use Gauss's law, you find that the electric field, I don't know what it is, to get all the numbers right, 2 pi epsilon r. Again, for r being r. Okay, this is, and therefore, the important thing is that the potential goes as lambda. It'd be easier to copy it with integrated. Log of r, let's say, over capital R. R is the radius of the cylinder. And now I'm taking, when little r is capital R, this is the log of 1, which is 0. So now I'm taking the 0 on the surface. Notice I can't take the 0 at infinity because the potential diverges at infinity. So this is a property of infinite surfaces. Infinite surfaces always have divergent potentials at infinity. Okay. Finite surfaces don't. Now, in real life, we never have infinite surfaces. But since DNA and microtubules are very, very long, it's easier to take them as infinite for the time being. But then we have to be careful, and we can't take the potential, when the potential diverges at infinity. Okay, so we have to take the 0 somewhere else, and you can take it anywhere you want, and it's easier to take it at the surface. Okay, this is now, of course, if the cylinder, as in real life, is finite, if I go very, very far away, and very far away means far compared, say, to the length of the cylinder, then the cylinder looks like a sphere, and then eventually the potential falls off as 1 over r, and where q is just lambda times the length of the cylinder, and then I can still take the potential to infinity. So there's always a crossover. But most of the time, at least we won't worry about that, okay? Because we're usually not interested in what goes on at such long distances. Okay, now, for most of what we do, it's sufficient to take the surfaces to be planar. Okay. So let's come over here and let's look at what happens on a planar surface. So that's fine. If we have a planar surface with now called sigma is equal to the charge per unit area of the surface. Remember, that's the thing that's 1 per square nanometer for a highly charged surface. Then we do the same, use this Gauss's law, we draw a little pill box, and that's, you know, the first thing you learn about capacitor in place is that the electric field is constant. So in this case, the electric field, let's get the pi's in the right point, 2 pi e sigma over epsilon. Most of the time, I'm going to take the charge density as a number of charges per unit area. So I take the charge of the electron out. Okay, I'll do that most of the time. So that's, the electric field is independent of distance from the surface. And that's the first thing we learn about condenser plates. Okay, that means the electrostatic potential is linear. Let's say the charge were negative, so that the electric field is negative, then the electrostatic potential is 2 pi e sigma over epsilon s. There's the surface, there's the x direction, the electric field, the electrostatic potential is linear. Again, I take it to be 0 when x equals 0. Take it to be the potential, 0 potential at the surface, diverging at infinity, just as I said it does for all infinite surfaces. In this particular case, now being a physicist, a lot of you are mathematicians, you also do the same thing. You like to work in dimensionless units. And these things have dimensions. Electrostatic potential has units of energy per charge. It's a funny unit. So I like to define a dimensionless potential. I usually do it as a script phi. And I'll just define it as E phi over t over kt. So I do measure all my energies in units of kt. I guess this puzzle is k Boltzmann. I always think of t as being including Boltzmann's constant. But OK. So this is a dimensionless potential. And then this thing becomes x over lambda, where lambda is an important length in all charged surface problems. It's called the Guey-Chapman rot length, and it's just defined as 1 over 2 pi sigma L. This is called the characteristic length of all surface charge. It has a surface charge that I didn't define. L. L is another length that's called the Bierhoff length, which is the characteristic length of all electrochemistry. It's just defined as E squared over epsilon t. This is an important number. That for water, E is the charge of the electron, epsilon dielectric constant of water, which is 80. T is, well, epsilon T is constant for water. Okay, so it's just a constant. And this is about, let's say, a half a nanometer. Okay, it could be 6 angstroms or 7 angstroms. It doesn't really make any difference because it's meaningless at that length scale. It's just a scale. Half a nanometer. Think of it as a half a nanometer. For water, that's water. If it had a different dielectric material, it would be different, but we like water. Okay. So that's an important length. This potential is this in dimensionless units. Okay. Pardon me?
KB.
No, it's because it's in here. It's in L.
Oh.
And it's in here, and so it canceled out. It's all okay.
So this length doesn't signify anything physical.
Okay, the answer is yes. The Bierhoff length is just the distance that two charges in water, so that they interact with an energy kT, so their Coulomb energy is kT. The Guey-Chapman length tells you something about where, as you'll see, where the counter ions lie. We'll get to that. I haven't put any counter ions. But it's a characteristic length associated with a charged surface because it has that parameter in it. Okay. And again, physicists, we like to think about lengths. Okay, so everything okay so far?
This is all in a vacuum.
Well, it's in water. I put it in a dielectric constant. But there's no counter ion. I mean, of course, these are charged surfaces. This is what you learned about freshman physics. Okay. Of course, that never occurs in nature. And as I said before, as far as any condensed matter physics is concerned, the electrostatic interaction is the dominant interaction. It's the only thing that plays. In fact, it's the only interaction to a first approximation that plays a role in anything. Okay, it's the strongest thing, and therefore it dominates. And therefore, positive and negative charges don't want to be separated very much. So therefore, things are always neutral. And of course, these are not neutral problems. And this is just what we teach first-year students because it's easier to teach this. But the real question now is we're interested in a neutral system, so that where are the neutralizing ions? Now, for the case of DNA, where I have these phosphates that are ionizing, the neutralizing ions are these small counter ions, say sodiums, or if I titrate them against calcium or lanthanum, or spermine and spermidine, it's these kind of ions. Okay, so the question that we have so much is a little bit so far so good, but where are all of these ions? We have to take them into account, and furthermore, we have to know where they are. Now, when we teach freshmen freshman physics, we don't have temperature in the problem. And of course, we don't have temperature here. I put it in artificially, as you say. I put it in and I canceled it out because I like to use dimensionless units, but there's no temperature here. But when we're interested in the problems that we're interested in, say in biophysics and DNA and things, we're always working at room temperature. And we're always in a state where fluctuations are important. Why fluctuations are important? Because we're alive. If we didn't fluctuate, then we'd be dead. So the fluctuations are important. So in a range where KT is a relevant length scale, is comparable to other, is a relevant energy scale. And in fact, where the counter ions go is a problem not of freshman E&M, it's a problem more of upper division, junior, senior level statistical mechanics. Okay, so we have to put in, so where the neutralizing counter ions go is, for example, let's think of the case of a sphere. If I had neutralizing counter ions, of course, where they would want to be at low temperatures is right on the sphere. The positive and negative attract each other very strongly. The only way you could do that is by boiling them off, so to speak, with temperature. Okay, so if we have roughly speaking, we know, I computed what the potential is. And the potential energy, if I had a sodium ion here with a charge plus E, then its potential energy would just be E times this phi. Now, where that is depends on E phi of R divided by KT. You see why I like that. And in fact, what we know from statistical mechanics is that the probability of finding a sodium at a distance R from a charged sphere would be proportional to the Boltzmann factor, even the minus phi of R, E phi, what I wrote over KT. That's the Boltzmann factor. That's the probability of anything happening. Okay, so that's beginning statistical mechanics, and I assume everybody knows about Boltzmann factors. Okay. So now, notice if I go to R equals infinity, phi goes to zero, this relative probability goes to one. So that means if I have a charged sphere in the center of an infinite bucket of water in the Pacific Ocean, all of the charges go to infinity. They just all boil off. Or the same thing, if I have a hydrogen atom in sitting in the center of the universe with nothing else around, and if the universe had a temperature T, it would ionize. And that's because the potential goes to zero at infinity. Situation for these infinite surfaces is different. The potential goes to infinity and infinity. That means infinite surfaces at a given temperature don't ionize. Okay. And that's a characteristic of infinitely charged surfaces. Okay, they just don't ionize. Okay. Now, so having said that, where are the counter ions? They don't ionize. It doesn't mean that they're all on the surface. They're not all on the surface. If they're all on the surface, then say DNA wouldn't be soluble in water. So where are they? So it's easy to look at that from this thing. So let me look at this electrostatic potential. I'll just do it for a plane. So you get the idea. So let me plot the dimensionless electrostatic potential versus distance from the surface, and it's a straight line, right? It goes straight to infinity, and the slope of that straight line is lambda. This is Guijin. Okay? Now I'm going to start putting in my neutralizing counter ions. Assume they're all monovalent and put them in one at a time. So what are they going to do? I put in a sodium here. This is the potential. It just slides down the potential to the surface. Right? I mean, it's like putting a ball on a slippery slope. Boom, goes to the surface. So I'll do the first one. But of course, when it goes to the surface, it neutralizes some of the charge. So the slope of this line goes down a little bit because the charge density is now a little bit lower, right? So the slope is a little smaller. And now I put the second guy on, but he still sees a straight line, slides down, and I just keep doing it. Well, as I keep doing it, the slope gets smaller and smaller and smaller, but it's always linear. That's the nature of this. It's always linear. Therefore, when I get to the last charge to make a neutral, it's still linear. Or maybe not for the last one, but for almost the last one. And that means that essentially all the charges have slid to the surface. And that's the physics of what I just said, that all the charges don't ionize, that all the charges are in the surface. But where are they? What's the length scale? The length scale, that's the fundamental length scale of the problem. So what that means is that all of the counter ions are within like a sheet, a film of thickness, the Gooey-Chapman length. And I mean, and that we could solve that. I mean, I'll show you how to do that later, but I want to tell you the physics because I don't want to get in, you know, when you write down equations, you don't know what they mean. So this is the physics. So the way to think of this is to think of all of the counter ions. When I say all, I mean 99% or 98% or some exponentially large fraction are within a Gooey-Chapman length of the surface. So that's where the counter ions are, and I haven't put in any electrolyte in the solution, any additional salt. That just makes it more complicated and awkward to think about it. So let's do it this way for the moment. That's what I want to tell you about charged surfaces, and I want to look at this problem a little closer. And the way I want to look at it closer is to now kind of show you how to work out what I just said. And I'll just do it for the plane, because that's the one that's
better eraser.
So the easiest way, so the problem is we have to know where the counter ions are for reasons that we'll see why we want to know where they are. And and this is a classical, in more ways than one, many body problem. It involves, we have this charged surface with those sigma counter ions per unit area, and these guys are all interacting with each other and with the surface. I kind of ignored the interaction with each other here slightly. I just said, well, it screens or reduces the slope. That's called screening, by the way, this reduction of the slope. So how do you do that if you wanted to do it formally? So in all problems of many body physics, and all of most interesting physics of many body physics, you start out by doing the same thing. You do what's called mean field theory. And mean field theory, as people like Roland know, for this particular problems of DNA that I talked about, is not very good. But nevertheless, it's important because it has all the right physics in it, and it shows you where the problems lie. Okay. So I want to do mean field theory, because this is the place you always begin. Because since we don't know how to solve problems with more than two or three particles in them, we always replace a many-body problem by a problem of two bodies, because that's the only one we know how to solve, in the cases we know how to solve. Okay, and that's called mean field theory. And the idea of the following is that you say just what I did here, that that each particular charge, like this counter ion, feels the average potential energy associated with all of the other charges, but not the specific potential energy, the average over some kind of ensemble that's associated with the, with say, the temperature that I'm working at. Okay, that's an approximation. And it's a very bad approximation here, but it's a place that we start to begin with. Okay. In for electrostatics, that mean field theory is called Boltzmann-Poisson approximation, like Poisson-Boltzmann, depending on whether you're French or was Boltzmann German or Austrian?
Austrian.
Anyway, he committed suicide, right?
Yeah. Because the
way it works is the following. You start out with Maxwell's equation that, as far as we know, for anything that we're talking about is exact. Okay, we have no reason not to believe it, which is that the divergence of the displacement is 4 pi times the charge density. This is the charge density. This is the, this is called something like Poisson's equation in three dimensions. I'm not good at names. Okay. And of course, we live in 3D, so we only do it in 3D. The problem is, is this okay so far? The problem is that we don't know where all the charges are. If we think of this problem of a charged surface, we know where those charges are because they're fixed on the surface. But we don't know where all of these neutralizing counter ions are that I told you are in the sheath. So we know some of the charges, we know the ones on the surface, but we don't know the other ones.
So the right hand side is unknown.
Yeah, but we don't know the left hand side either. So we have a problem. Okay. So we have to do some kind of self-consistent thing. So the what will assume? I mean, in my head, I'm thinking about that problem, the charge surface with the counter ions. We'll assume that everything is as ionized as it can be. That it's like a perfect plasma. We'll start at that limit, which is, I keep saying, is not the right limit, but we'll start at that limit. And then the idea is to say that the fixed charges on the surface, they're fixed. We don't do anything about them. We assume they're fixed. They're held together by covalent forces, and they're immobile. But the counter ions could be anywhere. So what we'll assume is this mean field assumption, that they're distributed with a Boltzmann distribution, because that's statistical mechanics, around the average potential. So that the rho of r is proportional to e to the minus phi of r over kt, where phi is we don't know either, but remember, this left-hand side is minus epsilon times the Laplacian of phi. Something like that. Okay, so now, put this in here, and now we may have several species of charges. We have positive charges and negative charges and so forth. But what's obvious here, because this is a Laplacian, that we know is right, this is a nonlinear second order partial differential equation. Okay, so being, whenever a physicist sees that kind of thing, he starts to throw up or something, because you don't like nonlinear partial differential equations. So the first thing you do, you linearize. And then you gotta figure out when is linearization good. Okay. So it turns out, okay, so we have, so this, by the way, so let me stop for 1 minute. This nonlinear second order partial differential equation, this mean field equation, is called the Poisson-Boltzmann equation. And unfortunately, and it's something that screwed this whole field completely, that, for this problem, is exactly soluble. And it ruined the field. Okay, it, it caused 30 years of delay in understanding. But okay, but I'll get back to that in a minute. But in general cases, it's not exactly soluble in the nonlinear form. You could do it, of course, numerically. So let's do what people did in many, many, many years ago. We'll linearize. And the linearized version is called the linearized Poisson-Boltzmann equation. But a second order linear differential equation, we could always solve. So no problem there. And this linearization is good. And I'll just tell it to you because you have to check it a posteriori afterwards. That this linearization is good for weakly charged systems. Okay, for weak charges, linearization is good. Now, the standard form of linearizing, I won't do it for this problem. It's easier to do it here, but it's more telling if I do it for this case where it's always done, and that's the case not of a charged surface, but just a salt solution. So let's think of an electrolyte solution. A glass of salt water. So in that case, I'll write down what the linearized equation is. Obviously, it's L squared. I'll use my dimensionless thing. It's kappa squared phi. That's what this equation looks like when I linearize it for a glass of salt water. And kappa squared is something like A. It's a constant. It's 1 over a length squared. 8 pi c. C is the concentration of salt. In other words, the number of moles of sodium chloride that it dissolves in my water, in my beaker of water, times L. L is my old friend there, the beer length. Notice this is a number per unit volume, that's a length, this is a number per unit area, it's the right unit. I'm taking phi to be zero at infinity. I'm linearizing what? What did you ask?
Are you linearizing about phi equals zero?
Around phi equals zero. So this is for weak potentials, which corresponds to low charges. Okay. No, it's no constant term because of the neutrality. There's as many positive as negative ions. So the concentration, there's no constant term. That's good. Oh yeah, so that's important. Charge neutrality is always important. Huh?
Yeah, he's right. I was going to say, you get the one minus, but the one goes away.
There's another term that goes as e to the plus. And the constant terms cancel when you expand. But that's a good point. So that's charge neutrality is crucial for that reason. Absolutely crucial. Okay, so now let's solve this equation. This equation we can solve. So the easy way to do it is let's focus. I'm in this big glass of salt water. I'm speaking fast because I don't have much time. Everything is homogeneous. So I'll just focus. I'll take my origin, let's say, on a sodium ion. So here's the origin of my coordinates with a plus charge, and let me solve this equation at that origin. And the solution of this equation is something like phi equals minus kappa r over r. By the way, kappa, the inverse of kappa is called the Debye screening layer. Okay. So C, that just comes from how many moles of stuff I dissolve. That's the solution of this equation. At short distances, it goes as 1 over r. And then it has this exponential screening. The electric field is shielded. Why is it shielded? Because the electric field due to this plus charge pulls in negative charges so that when they go far away, I don't see any charge. And it gets to neutral, and therefore it goes to zero. So that's the kind of exact solution of that equation. And that's what everybody remembers. For me, what's more important is the free energy of these things. So let's write down the free energy per unit volume. in units of KT. So I'm starting out with this hot, completely ionized plasma. So the first thing I have is the entropy of mixing of the sodium ion, entropy of the sodium ions and the chlorine ions. So the entropy of mixing of an ideal gas is C log C. C is the concentration. And I have two because I have two species. I have the sodiums and the chlorines. And that C is the same as that C. So that's the entropy of mixing. And now I have the energetics, the enthalpy, the electrostatics. So this is purely entropic. The electrostatics is what? Well, let's think about this a minute. Let's take some little volume of space. It's all homogeneous. If in that volume, obviously, there's as many positive as negative charges. There's no distinction between positive and negative. So on the average, it's as many positive and negative charges. And therefore, for every plus-plus interaction, there's a plus-minus interaction with the opposite sign. Therefore, the electrostatic energy of that unit volume is zilch, nothing. So that's it. That the total free energy is just the entropy of a two-component ideal gas. That's clearly bullshit, right? I've left out something, but that's pure mean field theory. That's the exact result in mean field theory, as long as I linearize this equation. Well, the free energy has two terms, has entropy plus enthalpy. Or in the usual jargon, if you learn it, something like U minus TS or something like that.
But then you divide it by temperature.
Oh, I always divide, I always measure, I always like to measure energy units in units of KT, so I always divide out KT.
And then you, what is this? You do a line and then volume?
Which line?
Oh,
this is supposed to be per unit. Okay, I'm sorry. The free energy in units of KT, and I'm just measuring that per unit volume. This is, in other words, how many dynes per, how many ergs per cc.
So that's equal to 2 times the concentration times what?
Yeah, this is the entropy of an ideal gas.
And then that's the natural log of the concentration.
Natural log of the concentration.
That's not correct because what do you think you said that's...
Well, no, it is correct. That is correct in this one. Well, and then I said then there's an electrostatic contribution, which is zero in the average. Because everything is homogeneous. This is a uniform plasma. For every two charges, if I look at two charges that are separated by distance r, they have a certain energy. There's as many positive negative ones as positive positive ones. They all cancel. So I get nothing. That's not good enough. We need some electrostatics in this because this is an electrostatic problem. So what do you do? Okay, so now we learn a little bit about mean field theory. The first thing you do in mean field theory, you solve it, then if you want to look at how big the fluctuations is, because this assumes that everybody sees the average field, but there are fluctuations because this is a finite temperature. So let's write down the fluctuation. Okay, so now I'm going to write it down because I know some statistical mechanics, but then I'll tell you how to do it, so I'm going to probably run 5 minutes late, because this is an important part. So a fluctuation corrections, for those of you who know a little statistics, fluctuations always lower the free energy, because if they didn't lower the free energy, they wouldn't exist, because free energies are always minimized. So the fluctuation correction has to be negative. We're talking about thermal fluctuations. So the energy associated with thermal fluctuations is KT. I already factored out the KT, so that's already done. And now this fluctuation correction, this term has dimensions of an energy per unit volume. So that means I need a volume. But in this problem, this is where I'm starting from. There's only one length scale in this problem, which is this inverse of this length. Since that's the only length scale in the problem, the only way I can make a volume is the cubit. So that's what the fluctuation correction looks like, times some number. Number. A pure number. Okay, then I'll put in the 1/12. So that's the first fluctuation correction. It's negative. And notice that it's proportional to the concentration to the 3/2. This is just, when you talk about ideal gases or non-ideal gases, you use what's called a virial expansion at low densities. You expand the powers of the concentration. And in a gas with short-range interaction, the first term goes to C squared. This goes to C to the 3/2 because there's something magic about this long-range Coulomb force, which I don't want to go into. But this is the first term of an expansion. Now, notice that these two terms work opposite to one another. This, remember, energies want to be minimized, free energies. This, if I only had this term, this could be a smaller and smaller if the concentration is smaller and smaller. So this term is pushing on the walls of the container. In fact, this is an ideal gas term. It's a pressure. Pushing on the walls of the container. This term lowers the free energy if the concentration gets big. In other words, right, because of the minus sign. So these two guys are antagonistic. Okay, yeah.
What's then the denominator?
It's 12 pi, because I put in the right number. I think it's 12 pi, I'm not sure. It's something like that. And I can tell you in private, if you don't like my derivation of that, if you want me to show you how to get the 12 pi, I actually know how to do that. But at this point, I'm giving you physics. I'm not giving you the arithmetic how to get here. Okay.
So these fluctuations, you're assuming everything you've done since the order of KT that they're of equal weight. So it's not just a correction. It's as large a term, in other words, as the first term.
No. This is as C goes. This is an expansion in a parameter actually, which is CL cubed. L be a Rofen. And so this is only good in low concentrations. So this is only valid if this term is smaller than that. Okay, but we're going to push it. Okay, but these two terms work in opposite directions, and they're equal to one another. When they're equal, you get a critical point. This is the classical situation of getting a critical point. And these two terms are comparable, which is outside the limit of where this approximation is valid, but it tells you what's going on. These two terms are equal when CL cubed is of the order of 1. I don't know if it's 1, it's 2 over pi or something like that. Doesn't make any difference. Okay. So, and what happens here? So this is some critical concentration. When there's one charge per Bjerm volume, remember what the Bjerm line is. That concentration corresponds to something like 10 molar in salt. And as you know, if you try to dissolve too much salt in a cup of water, it doesn't dissolve. This is what causes the so-called salting out effect. When the concentration is too high, you can't, the stuff has no reason to dissolve because you're not getting enough entropy. Okay. Now, that occurs, it's outside of the region where this approximation is valid. So if you do it more carefully, and people like Michael Fisher and others have done this, and other people have done it more carefully, so this is wrong by 10% or a few percent or something. But this is essentially the right answer. Now, then go back. Now, so the important thing is this free energy that there's a salting concentration that the solution cannot support, which is a 10 molar or something for this. And by the way, this C star is proportional to 1 over, let's say, Z to the 6, where Z is the valence of this salt. Here I did it for monovalent salt. But if it were divalent, this would be 2 to the 6 times lower concentration. And of course, you know you can't dissolve as much magnesium sulfate in water as you can sodium chloride. That's the reason for it. Okay, now, let's get back to our charred surface. In the case of the charred surface, as I say, you could solve, unfortunately, this Poisson-Boltzmann equation, because this is a one-dimensional problem. Okay, and I'll just tell you the solution. I mean, it's trivial, so there's no point in solving it. Most of you guys are mathematicians, and you could probably solve it in your head already. But it's pretty much, I told you the solution, is that the potential is 2 times the logarithm of 1 plus x over lambda, something like that. X over 2 lambda, it doesn't make any difference. That's lambda. And so you see the potential still diverges at infinity, albeit logarithmically. And the charge density, I wonder if I have the charge density, Roland knows in his head, goes as something like 1 over x plus lambda squared with some prefactor. Okay. Something like that. So clearly the charge density goes to 0 at infinity. Just what I said, all the charges are within the sheet of thickness lambda. This is the exact solution of that, of this equation, without these fluctuations. Okay. So now I'm gonna say one thing, and then I'm gonna stop, and then we'll take a break. The important thing I want to do is what I didn't do, but my thesis advisor always told me you should never do if you're a physicist, or told me the reverse. Always put in numbers. Physics is numbers. If you don't pick numbers, you're screwed. You get answers that may be right, but are irrelevant. So let me tell you the numbers. And that's the secret. Let's look at this Gouin-Chapman. I told you this is a half a nanometer. For a highly charged surface, for DNA, this is 1 charge per square nanometer. So this is 6 times a half is 3. 3 times 1 is 3. This is about a third of a nanometer, okay, for DNA. There's all kind of problems with that. As soon as you see that, you know you've done something terrible. Why is that? It's 3 answers. Because the distance between charges on the surface is a nanometer. 1 charge is a square nanometer. And I've assumed the charges are a continuum. Clearly, that's nonsense. So everything I've gotten from this continuum approximation where I assume the charge is wrong, because that's only the electric, that's not the electric field from a charged surface with discrete charges. That's from a uniformly distributed charge. So that's, as soon as I see that, I know I've done the wrong problem. Secondly, if lambda is only a third of a nanometer, and then I calculate what the charge density is in there. I know all the charges in there. I find something that way exceeds this. That means that the locally, it's not even stable. So therefore, this approximation where we solve this nonlinear equation with a coarse grain, with a homogeneous charges, is meaningless for DNA. Now, I'm going to say one more thing and then I'm going to shut up. Why is that so bad? Maybe it's okay, maybe it's wrong, but it gives you the right thing. But it's wrong, badly wrong. And it's badly wrong for something that I didn't talk about yet. And that's like, let's take 2 of these surfaces and ask what's the force between them. So we know that each of these surfaces has this little counter-ion sheath like this. And we can ask, what's the pressure between these two surfaces? Now, if based on what I've told you so far, it's easy, because in mean field theory, because these are identical surfaces, on this mid-plane here, the electric field has to be zero by symmetry. Right? Electric field is zero by symmetry. Therefore, there's no electric stress on the mean plane. The electric stress is E squared. E squared is zero on the midplane. Therefore, the only stress that could be exerted between these two surfaces is due to the entropy of the counter ions. So therefore, the pressure between these two surfaces is just exactly, this is exact what I'm writing, is kT times the density of counter ions on the midplane. Now that density is small, I've already told you, it's 4 morphos 1 over x squared. But whatever it is, it's positive. So this says there's a repulsive force between these two surfaces. And that's completely wrong. It's in this case, it's attractive. There are many ways of seeing that it's wrong. The repulsive force violates Earnshaw's theorem in some sense, which is a theorem about stability of electrostatics. The first day you learn, first day of class of freshman electricity and magnetism, literally. Secondly, it's wrong because you could see that the fluctuations give attractive forces. Because if there's a fluctuation, that means I take a charge from here and put it there, then this side becomes positive and this side becomes negative, and then they want a force. So all fluctuations lead to attractive forces. And it turns out that for highly charged surfaces, it's these attractions that win. And I'm not going to tell you why, but what I have told you is the framework in which you could think about it. Okay. So this is how people think about electrostatics and these kind of problems. And the way to solve, and you know, some other time where you could ask me or ask Roland in the corridors, how do you understand the attractive forces? And you see it has nothing to do with this way of thinking. But this way of thinking already shows you that this mean field theory doesn't make sense. As soon as you put it in, you didn't have to do any of the calculations. As soon as you realize that this is the length of the problem, which you do without doing anything, you realize that there's big problems when sigma is big. When sigma is small, there's no problem, because then the length is large and these red flags don't appear. The mean field theory is okay. But it's only in these cases of highly charged surfaces. Highly charged is always one charge per square nanometer, because that's an important number, because the other length scale is this one. Okay, so I'll stop here.